Only smart people get up early enough to listen to the Francine Marie Show. So thanks for listening, smarty pants.
Oi, Billy! Oscar! Dave! Get up! Francine Marie Show's on!
Good morning. Thanks for joining us. Today's topic weighs about 400 pounds, so I hope you can take this heavy one. It's about restorative justice. It's about what's happening in our jails during our coronavirus pandemic. It's about collateral consequences. Do you know what that is? Well, we're going to find out. And do you know about the company Corrections Enterprises? We're going to tackle this big old 400-pound topic with our new best friend this morning. It's attorney Timothy Emery. He is the founder of Emery Law Firm right here in Charlotte, North Carolina. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So are you in the courtroom these days?
When there's not a global pandemic, I'm usually in the courtroom at least 4 days a week, if not all 5 days of the week. I'm a criminal defense attorney here in Charlotte. I work in state court. I don't handle any federal matters. I represent people who have been accused by the police of crimes or wrongdoing, anywhere from traffic tickets all the way up to attempted murder and sex offenses. Many of the people that I represent contract with me, hire me. I also take court-appointed cases. We have a large public defender office here in Charlotte that they can't handle all of the volume of cases. So private attorneys who also accept court-appointed cases come in and handle matters. So I handle court-appointed matters as well. Disproportionately, people who are accused of committing crime by police are defined as indigent. They can't afford their own attorneys. The majority of folks that are represented by attorneys oftentimes have court-appointed attorneys.
Everyone's still having to post bond, right?
Still a lot of problems there right now. Worked with some other folks, with some other community leaders to form an organization called Decarcerate Mecklenburg. And we formed at the very beginning of this when it was announced that court was going to be closed effective Monday, March 16th. We had our first meeting on March 16th to advocate for release of people in Mecklenburg County Jail. What a lot of people don't understand, people use the term jail and prison interchangeably. However, jail is typically people who are awaiting trial, who have not been convicted, and allegedly in the United States, there's a presumption of innocence attached to every person who's accused of a crime. Prison is typically people who have been found guilty by a court and have sentenced to serve time. So Mecklenburg County Jail, which houses people who have not been convicted of crimes overwhelmingly, we have been advocating for the release of the majority, if not all, of the people in Mecklenburg County Jail. Jails and prisons are absolute hotspots when it comes to the spread of infections. Unfortunately, this COVID-19 outbreak is proving that to be true, that if you look at the top 20 hotspots around the country, it is not senior living facilities, nursing homes. It is jails and prisons, followed by meatpacking plants. So we put pressure on the Sheriff's Department. The Sheriff's Department is proud to say that there are no cases of COVID-19 in Mecklenburg County Jail. However, it's a little disingenuous because they aren't testing people. So you aren't going to have any confirmed cases if you aren't testing. And that's a little sleight of hand that doesn't, I don't think, adequately value the humanity of the people that are in jail. We don't want people to die, but my fear is people are going to die in that jail. Putting pressure on them to test and to provide masks for the inmates, they do not. They have masks for staff that is optional for them to wear, and the majority of staff in the detention center, in the jail, that I observe when I go to jail, are not wearing their masks. They aren't practicing good social distancing. It's impossible to social distance while you're in jail. So we're trying to put pressure there. We're trying to put pressure on the police department. CMPD has been the most resistant to change. They refuse to alter their policy and are continuing to arrest people on misdemeanors when specific North Carolina statute and law allows police officers to issue citations for misdemeanors rather than arrest. They are using their discretion in a poor way that doesn't promote public safety, that doesn't keep the community safe, that doesn't even keep the individual officers safe. That is causing a problem. We are putting pressure on the district attorney's office to consider agreeing to unsecure bonds where previously they haven't. There's some success there. We're putting pressure on the judges, on the court system to release people where normally they're not as inclined to. There's some success there, but there isn't a systemic policy. It's sort of a case-by-case piecemeal basis, and it's not an effective means to get out a large number of people in short order. The jail population has gone down, but it hasn't gone down to the extent to which we're seeing other decarceration efforts in other cities in this country. I think it's down from maybe like 1,500 when this started to maybe 1,300 or 1,350. Mm-hmm. And we're glad that the jail population is reduced.
We'll definitely talk about other cities, too, compared to Charlotte, North Carolina, when it comes to inmates and jail and prison. I was talking to Dr. Madeline with the Exodus Foundation, and she was saying we're doing a soap drive right now for prisons in South Carolina because they don't have soap. I'm like, what? Or they have those little bitty bars of hotel soap.
And then they have to pay for it. You know, many jails and prisons in this country provide a little sample travel size of some toiletries when you get arrested that lasts a couple of days. But then beyond that, they have to purchase it at commissary at inflated prices, you know, where corporations take advantage of people in these situations and gouge them for basic items that we think are basic sort of human needs and rights. And you also have people, if they don't have loved ones on the outside who can afford to put money on their commissary. It's sad when you look at how much money this state and in all states spend on prisons and jails and this the massive bureaucracy that is the criminal punishment bureaucracy that some people call the criminal justice system. But a thought leader that I follow calls it criminal punishment bureaucracy because it's a more appropriate title. We spend all this money and we can't even provide for the most basic needs of those people that are being caged.
If you're just not tuning in, it's attorney at law. It's Timothy Emery. We call him Tim because he's got all the answers. You've done a lot of work with expungements, and I applaud you for that because a lot of times you get a record, right? It's a criminal record if you have left a apartment building and they thought that you didn't clean up as good as you should have. You know, that could be on a criminal record. It's amazing.
Mm-hmm. There's what's referred to as collateral consequences of a criminal conviction, and that's just a fancy way of saying that in our society, not only whatever the punishment is for being accused and convicted of a crime, we're going to punish you in all these other ways, right? We aren't going to let you rent an apartment. We aren't going to let you avail yourself to government programs and assistance programs designed for people that are in need, such as those individuals. We aren't going to let you get a job. Those are called collateral consequences. There's over thousands of them that have been identified and articulated. An expunction is something that can help someone after the fact if they have a case that was dismissed. The presumption of innocence still applies, right? But there are people who don't get jobs because they were charged with a crime, but the case was dismissed. So they are presumed innocent. They were never convicted. They are innocent, and they don't get that job. So an expunction would be available there. There are limited circumstances that North Carolina allows for expunctions of convictions. If someone waits 5 years or in some cases 10 years after they finished their probation and they haven't picked up any new charges, where they can remove that item from their record so that if they apply for a job or an apartment, nothing will show up, which is nice. But it is a really ineffective means of helping. I often consult people, can I get this off my record? Come back and you know, you got 2 years of probation and then 10 years after that, so 12 years. Well, what does the person do in the meanwhile? How do they try and survive in this society? We aren't really interested in rehabilitation. We say the words rehabilitation, but nowhere in this system is rehabilitation really a goal That's why things like restorative justice provide really compelling alternatives to punishment. All this system, all this so-called criminal justice system does effectively is punish. Quite effective at that. We have 5% of the world's population and 25% of the world's prisoners. We disproportionately punish black and brown people in this country. You know, sometimes we see cases and you see a white person is given a quote slap on the wrist, right? And people say they ought to be punished more. And I certainly understand that motivation to get, you know, get a little tit for tat. But what the real answer is, and what people who identify as abolitionists myself, is not that we want white people to be punished as severely as black and brown people are punished, because that is not right. That is not equitable. We want everyone to have access to the type of justice that white people often receive in the system. That is approaching something more equitable. And ultimately, what people who identify as prison abolitionists, severe criminal justice reformers want is to reimagine a society where punishment isn't our only aim or goal. I'm not saying punishment doesn't have a purpose, but restorative justice, addressing the harm for not only for the offending, the responsible party who caused the harm, but for the person who was harmed. You know, our system isn't adequate at addressing the person who is harmed. There's no restoration really there of that. And that's something that restorative justice aims to do. It is truly a victim-centered approach that ultimately has shown really prodigious results in the little bit it's been used and has been around, in terms of not only allowing the victim to feel like they've had their harm addressed, but that the offending person understands the depth of the harm caused and is far, far less likely to cause harm in the future. That's an example of something we're pursuing rather than, you know, punishment for punishment's sake.
Well, let's talk about other cities like Charlotte, North Carolina, compared to other cities when it comes to restorative justice. We've been doing a lot of training in the law enforcement field so that we can de-escalate issues so we don't shoot people more than we've been seeing people shot or killed. So how does Charlotte, North Carolina, in your opinion, as an attorney, compare to other cities? And by the way, Tim is from Nebraska. This is the first time I ever met anybody from Nebraska.
This is true. You know, de-escalation is really important. There's been some data that tends to suggest that in communities where the police departments undergo rigorous de-escalation, mandatory de-escalation training, there is a significant reduction of police officer use of force cases. And I think that that's important. In Charlotte, Police Chief Kirk Putney will be happy to tell people that, oh, we have de-escalation training for our officers. I think the one that they did that he really loves to promote, it was like an hour or 2 hours. That is insufficient. You know, if you have to do 12 hours of firearms and range training a year, and then you go sit in a classroom for 2 hours of de-escalation training, I mean, what does that say about your priorities? Some police departments, and ironically enough, one that really went above and beyond what most police departments do in terms of de-escalation training is the Minneapolis Police Department. They mandated that every police officer in Minneapolis go through 40 hours of a week-long 40-hour de-escalation training course. And after they did that, they saw a significant decrease in use of force cases. Of course, what did we see just 3 days ago on Monday? Minneapolis police officer murdered a man while other officers stood by and able to allow that murder to occur. And that tragic murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis, I think, to me, supports the idea that, you know, people that call for reforms and say we need to reform, we need more oversight, we need more accountability, we need more training, we aren't going to train and reform our way out of this police problem in the United States. Minneapolis is proof positive of that. You see what is happening right now in Minneapolis, and now you see the community is protesting what happened to Mr. Floyd and the ongoing abuses, and the police are responding by asking people that shows it doesn't work. Minneapolis Police Department, a long time ago in the early 2000s, addressed a very progressive reform requiring find written consent to search forms for any time police officers ask to search someone's vehicle or home and the person consented. You know, before the era of body-worn cans, and body-worn cans are not a panacea by any stretch of the imagination, but before that era where officers had cameras, you have many cases where the officer would say, oh, the person consented to a search of his vehicle, and then we found this, that, and the third. And then my client would say, I did not consent. They pulled me out of the car, put me in cuffs, and started searching, you know. Wow. Minneapolis was having this issue, and so they said, you've got to get a written consent form signed by the person before you search. Now, of course, that's subject to some coercive elements and fraud, but it's a step above what, say, we do in Charlotte. So they have that. Yet you still see the problem of the racist policies, the racist policing, and the use of force, which disproportionately goes against Black and Brown people. I also throw in Indigenous when you're talking about places like Minnesota as you go further out west. So the real issue, I believe, is that policing, if you understand the history of policing in the United States, the modern sort of policing came to fruition, particularly in the South, at the end of the Civil War, because now there was suddenly a need to regulate the conduct and lives of all of these formerly enslaved Africans. During slavery, you just left it up to the person, the white person that believed that they owned these enslaved persons to handle punishment and conduct and whatever. So when slavery allegedly ends, at the end of the Civil War, the police step in and they create a pseudo system of slavery, and laws are passed, now referred to as the Black Code, that essentially criminalize blackness. And policing has never really left that. Policing serves to maintain systems of power and domination, which, if you're talking about the United States, you're talking about white supremacist systems, you're talking about white supremacy, and to regulate the order of things, protect businesses, and protect business interests. And that's what policing continues to do. So that's why you see this disproportionality. A white supremacist system does not require individual acts of discrimination and racism by individual officers. It is an overall system that has the effect of implementing racist policy and the racist policing, which creates the disproportionality that we see. So I can't sound like a broken record, but I identify as a police abolitionist. I want to defund police. We spend so much of our taxpayer dollars on so-called public safety policing. In Charlotte, that number is near 50% of the static budget. You know, the things that are unchanging when you take out specific building projects and things of that nature. Nearly 50% of our solid static budget goes to Charlotte Police Department. We are getting ripped off. We are not getting our money's worth. Police answer to everything is give us more resources, give us more police, give us more resources, let us invade more aspects of your life. Do they produce results? No. Does crime go down? No. Crime goes up? The answer is give us more resources. Crime goes down? They say, oh, look, we're doing a good job. So give us more resources and we'll do even better.
Oh, wow.
The reality is crime has been on a decrease in this nation, and Charlotte's no different, from the mid-90s to very recently. So we had 25 years of solid decreases of crime across the board every single year. And in the last year or two, it flipped a little bit up. And Charlotte is one of those communities that's had an uptick in some measurements of crime, not all. And people have lost their mind. And when I say people, I mean generally the white privileged class of this community, and this perception that crime is out of control. And even during all those 25 years of crime decreases, you would survey people and people would say, oh, crime is out of control. Is crime worse now than it was 10 years ago? People would say, yes, yes, yes. The data, the facts show that it's not. But that's because while crime was decreasing 50% nationwide over that time period, coverage of crime in local television news was going up 400%. That phrase, if it bleeds, it leads, comes from somewhere. And that was when local news learned that it was profitable to cover crime, to perpetuate fear. Engenders the most fear in a racist society, but the picture of the scary black man. And that's what they've done, and that's the formula that they followed. So no one's really thought to look at the data and say, actually, crime has decreased since the mid-90s pretty significantly. Maybe we ought to spend less resources on our policing and invest in other aspects of ways to address harm in the community. Trust the community, trust community resources, et cetera, to address these issues. One of the most dangerous situations for any person that interacts with police, people who are struggling with mental health issues. I want to live in a society where if I have a loved one who's in a mental health crisis, I will not call 911. To call 911 is to invite an armed response. Call the police is to invite an armed response to the situation. That person's in a medical crisis. They don't need an armed response. They need mental health professionals who understand what's going on with them and can talk to them and can help get them access to services. So while de-escalation training is wonderful and very needed and has shown success, what I think would even be more successful is that we have people totally outside of the realm of policing who are responding when someone's in crisis. That will keep the whole community safe, not only that individual, but the people around them, the community that they're a part of.
You have been doing this for quite some time and very passionate about it. If you're just now tuning in, we got a new best friend. We're calling him Tim, but in the courtroom, it's attorney Tim Emery, founder of the Emery Law Firm. You have been a delight this morning sharing so much. I know that I got a source and they would say something to the tune of this, not verbatim, but when the jails are kind of empty, they really want to fill them up because mm-hmm. they make more money. And I'm like, wow.
Yeah.
A memo will go out. I need to fill these jails up because they're too empty right now.
There's a lot of money to be made off the warehousing of human beings and the caging of human beings. If we create a permanent underclass in our society of black and brown people who we have burdened with criminal convictions, then we have a really vulnerable, accessible labor force, right? Amazon, Bezos isn't on the fast track to becoming a trillionaire by paying his employees a living wage. No, I have a lot of clients who, you know, get jobs, contracting, delivering for Amazon, and they are not paid well. You know, and these are frontline workers right now. These are the people who are taking the greatest risk interacting with the public, delivering our packages because we're trying to not go out and shop. You know, grocery store, food service employees taking great risk, presumably would not take that risk if they weren't burdened with criminal record and had access to adequate education and housing and job opportunities. Instead of we refer to neighborhoods as high crime neighborhoods, if we instead refer to them as what the real root cause is of low employment opportunity neighborhoods, we think about those communities a lot differently than we currently do. So there is money to be made off of creating a permanent underclass in the warehousing of human beings. There is a corporation here that was created by North Carolina General Statute. I believe it's called Correction Enterprises. I may have that name wrong. You can go online and go to their website, see their annual report, and see that they made something like $90 million in profits last year. And the way they do it is they manufacture items that are made by inmates in North Carolina prison system. And do they pay those people a living wage? Of course not, because the law allows you don't even have to pay the minimum wage. In fact, they are capped at a maximum of $2 per day. And in order to get that $2, they have to work a full 8-hour workday. So you have people in the prison system who are working 8-10 hours a day, making $2, right? A quarter an hour is the highest possible pay rate. And they are making products that are then being sold out in the private marketplace for a massive profit. right? Wouldn't that be wonderful? I mean, that's why private businesses would love to get into that. Man, it would be wonderful to not have to pay people a living wage, but to take inmates, pay them pennies on the dollar, and then our profits, our bottom line will be higher, our stockholders will be happier, et cetera. So one thing that an average person could do is, if you're invested in mutual funds, stock market, talk to your financial advisor and make sure that you are not investing in any mutual fund that has as part of it people that are part of that machinery, that prison industrial complex.
Wow, just to go to dinner with you or have drinks with you or just to go out to have the party and it's like, oh, there's Tim over there. Let me introduce you to him. People don't want to leave your side. Okay.
Well, if I talk long enough, they eventually, their ears start bleeding.
And just give them a cotton swab. All right. It's like, you're going to need this cotton swab because I'm going to talk to you for that long. All right. Yeah. Timothy Emery, the founder of the Emery Law Firm. You have been a delight this morning. So, tell us where to go online. Tell us where to go online. And do you believe in the social media?
Social media can be a powerful way for marginalized people to get their message out. You know, I mean, it can be a destructive force, but it can also be a powerful force. If you Google hashtag decarcerate Mecklenburg, we have a Facebook page. You can learn about us. We have Freedom Friday events driving around. We're having a mobile protest that we do pretty much every Friday, driving around the jail, the courthouse, the DA's office, the police department, honkingly kick signs to our car, and demanding attention and interrupting the daily order of things promotes getting people out of jail during this pandemic. I mean, being accused of a crime should not be a death, and that's what's going to happen when the infection starts to really spread within Mecklenburg County Jail. There are people right now that are in jail, that are in quarantine, that are suspected of having COVID-19, but aren't being tested. That's a moral crisis, as far as I see it. So, search that. Do research on criminal justice reform issues. There are so many wonderful organizations that are doing great work. The Appeal is a great resource for news and information nationwide about criminal justice issues for people that really care about embracing a system that tries to live up to that word justice, because I don't think we have it right now. I always tell people when I give talks to groups, I used to say things like our broken criminal justice system, and I don't say that anymore. It's not broken. It's working exactly as it was intended to, and that's the darn problem. It's not broken at all. It is working perfectly, but that perfection is morally bankrupt, and I don't want to live in a society that has this system.
Right now, go to emerylaw.com, emerylaw.com, spell it E-M-R-Y, LAW.com. Timothy, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to the Francine Marie Show. We're popping out for a quick cup of tea, but we'll be right back.
Please, please do not harm us. We have come to your planet for one thing, the Francine Marie Show. It's the only content we can digest.